You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I'm really excited for this conversation. We're going to be talking to Nick DiGilio, who is an award-winning broadcaster, film critic, writer, and performer who has been doing this work for four decades. He's probably best known for his 35-year career at WGN Radio, including over 20 years hosting the number one rated overnight show. But today, Nick hosts two hit podcasts, the Nick D podcast, and That Show Hasn't Been Funny in Years, and an SNL podcast, which is about Saturday Night Live. And he has a new book called 40 Years, 40 Films. Enjoy the pod. Nick DiGilio, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Kelly, how are you, man?
I'm doing well, and I really enjoyed your book.
Thanks.
We're going to talk about a bunch of the films that you write about, but the book is also, and this is the thing I didn't know that the book would be about, because it's kind of a memoir of where you were personally in your life for each of these 40 years of doing this work and before. And so it probably makes sense for us to start at the beginning, because I know I wouldn't be where I am today without my dad, and I think you'd say the same thing. You're one of the only people I'd say.
Yeah. It's absolutely true. When I was a young kid, my dad took me to movies that I had no business seeing. I saw really inappropriate movies at a very young age. I saw The Exorcist when I was eight, which I think explains.
No.
Yeah,
it explains
a lot of
everything.
Stuff
about them. Yeah.
And my father would take me every Sunday morning. We'd go down to the Loop and see movies in the big theaters down there. The Chicago Theater is still there. The Niederlander, which used to be the Oriental, was another one. There was the Woods, the United Artists, the McVickers, the Roosevelt, a ton of theaters within walking distance. It was kind of like 42nd Street for people who are too young to remember what it was kind of like in the Loop. And at that time when I was growing up, they were just crap holes. They were like sort of rat infested, and they were showing triple features of Kung Fu movies for $1.50. And that's where I grew up. That's where I saw all the big movies, rat infested, crazy, and mostly with African-American audiences, which was a blast, because until I was about 11 or 12, I thought you were supposed to yell back at the screen. I thought that was part of the thing. And that's, I'm not saying that it's absolutely true. Yeah, so that's where I grew up. I grew up in those theaters, and my dad took me every Sunday. We went down there, and my obsession with movies began at a really, really, really young age. Horror was the big one. That's the one that, and you know that, Kelly. That's the genre that grabbed me, that I was fascinated by, and had posters of all the Universal monsters on my wall when I was a little kid. I watched creature features. I watched the original Svengoolie, Jerry G. Bishop, and then would go to these movies every Sunday with my dad, and then expanded outside of horror. But, yeah.
So what's interesting, so you're another love you've always had is comedy. And we've been having these conversations around Second City lately that, and I guess Jordan Peele would be someone who knew this inherently, that comedy and horror are kindred spirits.
I've said that forever. And I probably said that because I've heard it somewhere else, but from smarter people. But
I don't know. I don't know that that's a trope that people talk about necessarily.
It's interesting because both horror and comedy, they kind of appeal in the same way, because like you when you're scared, you laugh afterwards, and it's very like, you feel great afterwards. It's relief. It's like if you have a lot of crap going on in your brain and you want to confront it. A horror movie is a great way to do that, and so is a comedy. But yeah, they work on the same emotions, I think, and the same part of your brain and the same part of your heart get tested while you're watching comedy as much as you are when you're watching horror. And That's why so many horror movies are either unintentionally or intentionally really funny, which is, you know, goes hand in hand.
Timing, surprise. I mean, like, it's just interesting. So you also talk about the in your evolution of a watcher of the media, getting the VCR. I completely remember this because we got the VCR with the remote, except the remote was tied.
It was a cable, about 4-inch cable.
Yeah, it might have been 6-inch.
Mine only paused. That's all it did. Like, it was like it was a remote. It was about, I don't know, it was about 4 feet long, to say, you know, but it never reached the couch. I had to, you know, all it did was pause on your big 70-pound VHS tape that had to be inside the top loader, which you had to push down with all the strength that you possibly could. It was a life changer back in like 80 or something, or 79.
Sure.
79.
You could suddenly see, and you know, I ran a video store, so and I don't know if you have, did you see what the Davis is doing now? The Davis Theater?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've noticed that. Well, those guys, the Will and those guys who kind of do Oscar bait, who work with the guys at the Music Box as well, they're all over the place. And they've been doing, you know, that they've been pushing VHS. They've been putting, and I know Joe Swanberg has something to do with that too. Filmmaker.
He's got his collection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's pretty cool. I think it's great that they're bringing back. I mean, cause every time I go to the Music Box now, Kelly, I think you can identify with this. I feel like I'm 90. You know, like I walk in there and I'm like, all these young, like 19, 20 year old cinephiles. And, you know, I don't know. Can I swear on this podcast?
I'll let you.
Okay. Well, sure. because really quickly, I'll never forget this. I was standing outside of the Music Box Theater during the 70 millimeter film festival. This was only about a year and a half ago, two years ago in the festival. And there were a whole bunch of like young, you know, people who are getting introduced to VHS and DVDs and all that stuff now. And we had just seen 2001. Okay. And the next screening, I was waiting for the next screening to begin. The next screening was John Carpenter's Starman, which is, of course, a movie I love because it's John Carpenter. And I'm standing out there, and there are a group of like 20 something hipsters who are out there talking. And one of them says, "I'll tell you something, man. That monkey bullshit at the beginning made no sense at all." And I just went, "There it is. That kind of sums the whole thing up of 2001. And for me, that part of the movie makes the most sense. I don't know. But young people are diving into the old stuff now. And I think that's really cool.
It's great. And I suspect, because you and I are very close in age, and of course we kind of grew up together, if not always in this, but you know, we were both like the youngest guy. We were like a young producer, and you're young. And then you wake up one day and you're like, "I am no longer the young guy." And that's what happens when you go to the Music Box and you see, because it's great. It is. And the fact that they're doing well at a time when other places aren't.
Absolutely.
But I think they've discovered something about their audience. All right. So then you're this kid growing up in Chicago. You see all these inappropriate movies. You get the VCR. You're watching Creature Features. Yeah. You know, huge,
absolutely,
huge thing.
Yep.
And then you start calling into my dad's show on WGN.
Yeah. To your dad's eternal frustration, I think. I listened to your dad's show religiously. You know this, Kelly. Yep. The book's dedicated to your dad, you know. Mm-hmm. He's one of my heroes. There's no question about it. I wouldn't have a career without the guy. And I acknowledge that every single day of my life, Kelly. Every day. And I listened to him when I was a kid, when I was really young. I grew up on Addison, just blocks away from Wrigley Field, so I am a Cubs fan. Mm-hmm. So, which means WGN was on all the time. My house. Yeah. And now, Grant, you come from a big family. I'm an only child, so it's just me and my folks. And so it was just the three of us, and we would have WGN 24/7, not just because of the Cubs, but because of Wally and because of Bob Collins and all the, you know, all of the guys. But your dad was the coolest, man. He was the coolest of all of them. You know that. And like everybody else, you know, I liked listening to them, but there was something about your dad. Your dad was the hippest. Where does this guy come from? You know? And he talked about movies. He talked about plays. He talks about all the stuff that I was interested in, the arts. But here's the thing. When I was a kid, I started reading movie reviews at a very young age. I mean, the life-changing event was when I saw Halloween in the theater, and everything changed. But anyway, I started reading film criticism, and I started reading Roger and Gene. You know, Gene was writing for The Trip at the time, and Roger was writing for the Sun-Times, and I could read their stuff, but they weren't accessible. You know, your dad, I could call your dad, and we listened. I mean, the Saturday show was when I listened the most. I couldn't listen during the week, obviously, because he was on middays and I was in school and whatever. But every Saturday I listened. Every religiously I listened to your dad. And I can't tell you how many passes I won to King Richard's Fair. It's just an
and a Seymour Paisin scarf.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I would call up your dad, you know, because he was accessible. So I'd call up and I'd go, "Hey, why didn't you like Caddyshack?" Like something like that. And then your dad would go, "Well, I don't know. How?" And then he, I remember he asking me this one time, "You know, if you take a date to that movie, how do you feel about the nudity?" And I went, "What? What?" And but I loved listening to your dad, and then like I just started calling your dad on a regular basis, and then I, you know, your dad, I don't know what he saw in me, but he was like, you know, this kid knows his stuff, and you know, like I have like a weird and always have like an encyclopedic knowledge of movies, and so like it got to the point where like I could call the hotline and get on the air if he needed to, you know, something like a question about a movie, I could answer it, and then your dad started to put me on the guest list for all of the movies that he would host that GN would sponsor when they would do the screenings, radio station sponsored screenings, which don't really happen anymore.
No, nope.
But your dad hosted one like almost every month, it seemed. Mm-hmm. And they were usually at the Old Orchard. And so I started to get like the invites. I didn't have to call in, you know, and be the 19th caller or whatever. Your dad just put me on the list. And then I got to know him and I became kind of a regular caller on the show. The producer at the time, and I can't remember what his name was, the producer at the time.
Was it Peter? Peter Marino?
It might have been Peter. It might have been. Yeah, it might have been Peter. In 1985, like January of 1985, he was leaving.
Yep.
And so at this point, I established a relationship with your dad. I was going to screenings, and he kind of invited me to like critic screenings every once in a while, too, the private ones, every once in a while. And he's like, "You should go in and interview for this." And I'm like, "Oh, okay." But I had no broadcast experience. I had no radio experience. I dropped out of Columbia and I was working at Jewel. That's what I was doing. And so suddenly I'm going in to be interviewed for, you know, producer. And Lorna Gladstone at the time was the PD. And she, you know, interviewed me. And I rightfully didn't get the gig. I had no, but Nina Neuhauser got it. Nina was great. Fabulous producer. Fantastic. So she got the gig and she deserved it. But your dad calls me up personally and he says, "Hey, man, I'm really sorry you didn't get the job. They went with Nina." And I'm like, "No, that makes sense. I would have hired her too." And then he said, "But listen, I'm kind of tired of seeing crappy movies. I'm done. I can't. You like the kung fu. You like the horror. Why don't you review those for me? And we'll make it official." And I'm like, "What?" So my consolation prize, Kelly, because I didn't get the job as the producer of a radio show, was to be a film critic on your dad's show. So I think I got the better gig. I'm pretty sure I got that. So that's how it all started. Your dad called me up, said, "I don't want to see the crap anymore. You review it." And then it evolved into me co-hosting with him and then becoming a recognized film critic.
I don't know if you remember this or even know this, but before I married my wife, Anne, my dad hired her to come on and do the same thing that you did, but with the theater he didn't want to see.
That's right. I totally remember that.
It was like, "I don't want to see this thing."
I remember
Anne, you're going to love this. Anne's like, "Hey, I just saw this thing that you would absolutely love. It's a musician. I've never heard of him. Your dad didn't want to go to it. I guess his name is Andrew Bird." And she had saw Andrew Bird's Bowl of Fire
at
the Mercury Theater.
Oh, and man.
After she gave it a rave review, he found our phone number and called to say thank you. Because prior to that, no one was going. And my dad moved tickets. So
there's no question that he did. There's absolutely no question that he did. I remember in a similar story, there was this film that came out that Kevin Reynolds directed in 1988 called The Beast. It's on my top 10 in this book in 1988. And it was only playing at like two theaters. One of them was the Webster Place. And I think, and I still think it's an amazing film, an absolutely amazing film. George D'Souza, Stephen Bauer, Jason Patrick, a great war movie, really intense, really brilliant. And nobody was seeing it. Nobody was talking about it. And I remember one Saturday that I reviewed it. Your dad couldn't make it to the screening. So I reviewed it and I gave it this unbelievable rave. And then later that day, I was going to see it again. I was going to go with some friends and see it. And there was a line at the Webster Place. There was like a line almost around the block. And I'm walking up and down, and I was with my old friend Sergio Mims, who was a wonderful guy and a great film critic. And we were walking up and down. So Sergio, because I'm not one to go up and go, hey, how'd you find out about this? Because I don't, you know, I'm, but yeah. Sergio was walking up to people going, did you hear this on WGN? How many of you people heard this man review it on WGN? And I'm telling you, three quarters of the crowd raised their hands. Yeah. So we heard it on Roy Leonard show. And I'm like, well, man, that's, it's absolutely true, man. It's absolutely true.
All right. So let's, this is a really good book and a really interesting book. And part of it, so it starts in 85 in terms of when we're going through the films. And it's both interesting in terms of what you picked as your best film. And I was surprised how often I agreed with you, because I like, you know, you'll take a wild take.
I sometimes do. Yeah. And it's not on purpose. That's just me.
No, it's just you.
Yeah.
But then, and then when you look at your other films and you're just like, those came out in the same year. It's kind of mind blowing. And so let's talk about the first one, because this is one of my favorite films of all time.
Me too.
Okay. Lost in America by Albert Brooks. If you have not seen it, you kind of have to. It's required.
It's a must.
If you're interested in this. And I love what you say. You say, quote, Lost in America says more about 80s yuppie culture than any movie ever made, end quote. 1,000%.
Yeah.
It's a and also, deep satire.
Also came out barely 4 years into yuppieism. Like, it nailed it early. Like, I mean, that crap went on through the beginning of the 90s. And Albert Brooks demolished it in Jan. And when that movie came out in February of 1985. So it was very early in the year. And he nailed it, right? And it's still hilarious. I mean, I watch it like, I don't know, a couple of bi-monthly. And I think Albert Brooks to me is a comedic genius. I think he's the funniest. He's brilliant. He's made seven movies and they're all great. And five of them, I think, are comedy masterpieces. But yeah, no, Lost in America, which I saw at a screening, your dad invited me to, a screening. And it was about a month or two before, I was asked to come in and interview. And it was at, there was a screening room in Evanston. I want to say it was Cine Center, but before they moved down to, it was Cine Center, and it was in Evanston. And so that's where I saw that and After Hours on the same day. It was an unbelievable day. Like, those, like, oh my God.
That's two. And then, okay, so some of the other movies of that year, Ron, Back to the Future.
I know, man. Yeah.
Pale Rider, Fandango, Blood Simple, which that's the first Coen Brothers movie, right?
The first Coen Brothers movies. Yeah. Yeah.
Day of the Dead and Maria's Lovers. I mean, this is a murderer's row of
it
movies.
Yeah, it is. It was 19, and that was my first year. And I was like, oh, if this is what it's like every year, this is great. But it's not like that every year.
All right. So I'm reading this and I'm like, I love Lost in America. You've got me. And then when 1986 comes up, and you know what movie it is, I go, my dad hated this movie.
Hated it. I was sitting next to him in the Plitt screening room. What was the Plitt screening room then? The Lake Street screening room. And I was sitting next to him. And man, when it was over, he was just, you liked that? And I'm like,
just incredulous. So we're talking about David Lynch's Blue Velvet. Yeah. Again, if you haven't seen it, I'm going to say it's a must-see. Yeah. I loved it, but I understood why my dad hated it.
Oh yeah. No. And it's funny because, like, not only was it funny immediately afterwards and anytime we had a conversation, but when we reviewed it on the Saturday that it opened and I was like, oh, this is the best movie I've seen all year. And it came out in the fall. It was like September. And so by that point I was like, oh, this is the best movie I've seen all year. And he's like, are you crazy? And I'm like, no. And then inevitably, you know, the callers, the WGN callers would agree with your dad. Like, they were calling me up. And I remember the complaints came, you know, I will tell you this really quickly, Kelly, your dad went to bat for me a lot because there were a lot of times when, you know, I would really tick off management or not management, but I would really tick off the listeners and the callers would call in and the complaints would fly in and they would mail or call up all the time. And then every once in a while, PDs would be like, and you know, I've seen 100 PDs come through bosses come through GN over the years. And I would say 75% of them wanted me gone. And every time your dad went to bat for me, he's like, nope, he's staying on the show. That's all there is to it. But and one of those times was me defending Blue Velvet at a time when people were like, it was safe to say, nope, GN doesn't like it. So,
yeah, but I think this is what my dad always kind of got, which is like, you have got to make your, if you want to continue to innovate and you're in a creative field, you have to make yourself uncomfortable.
That's a good point.
Would,
yeah.
he could have stayed doing the same thing forever. I know this for myself. I mean, I quit producing Second City when I was at the top of my game, when everyone would have let me keep doing what I was going to do. That was 10 years ago. I am a happier person now because I did that and I'm doing interesting work. And I just don't think I saw how people rested on their laurels at Second City when I was the young producer.
Yeah.
And you know what I'm talking about.
We felt that. I mean, I performed on that stage I was with Second City for a long time. Late 80s is when I mm-hmm. took classes at Players, and then I went to Second City and I did all that. And when I was at Second City, Farley was on main stage. That's the time. Yeah. That's the timing that we're talking about. So, and Tim Meadows, but I saw it happen. It was just like every single review became like it was the same thing over and over again. Yeah. And I was with a company called the Factory Theater, and they did a play where they insulted you, actually, Kelly, in the play.
Yeah, they sure did. My dad went and reviewed it.
Oh, I know he did. I know he tore it apart. It was fantastic. But I was with the company at that time, the Factory Theater, and they did a show, and it was a bunch of like people who didn't make it to Second City. Like, they didn't make it to the main stage, and they were pissed. And so they did this play. And parts of it were funny. It was set up like a review. It was blackouts and so on and so forth and stuff like that. There was a time when like all of that was kind of the same, and they took a pot shot, and the Factory at that time took a pot shot at it. But it really was weird, because I specifically remember when that play opened at the Factory, it was right around the time when stuff started to change at Second City, when it wasn't just by rote anymore. When they started to take your chances, when Adam McKay was on stage doing amazing stuff, and Annoyance would come in and
Mick Napier.
Yeah, sorry, Norm. Mick Napier would come in and he did some stuff with Second City. And this was unusual, because it was like the edgy sort of storefront theater crowd was suddenly at, that dynamic was at Second City. So the timing of this show at the Factory was ill-timed. And I remember your dad coming to see it, and I'm like, well, wait a minute, because like, and then if I remember correctly, a few months later, or maybe 6 months later, 7 months later or something, Pinata opened, and it was like, well, wait a minute, now we can't make fun of this anymore. It's not, it's not possible.
Yeah, and it's funny because you weren't in that show, right?
No.
Yeah, and I had just started as producer, and I remember that I was new. I think they made fun of me because I was a dishwasher who became a producer or whatever.
Yes.
And I remember I didn't go to see it, but I remember talking to my dad. I've told the story before, and my dad, and this is not directed at you, but it was directed at a couple of those people who I did kind of know, but he said, do you respect these people? I go, well, no. He goes, then why do you care?
Right.
And I'm like, this is such a Roy Leonard thing, which is like, you and I will never be able to do that.
No, of course not.
But he could. And I have no idea how. Yeah. This guy had the worst childhood. He had not an easy way coming up, and somehow sort of found this way of like, I'm just going to like, it's total improv thing. I'm going to be present in the moment I'm in, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that was one of the many things that made your dad so special. I learned a lot of that from him. Like, I mean, when I first came on his show, I was a real smart ass and edgy and all this other stuff. And then Roy would pull me aside and go, you might want to, and he wouldn't like scold me, it wasn't like, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to change this, you need to change that. But I would watch him, and I would watch the way that he was as a person and as a broadcast, the best interview I've ever seen. He's the best interviewer that I've ever seen in my life. And I also love the fact that he's 30 seconds into a commercial and you don't know it. Like, you're like, wait, is he reading a commercial right now? What the hell is happening? But I learned so much from him, not just as a broadcaster and as a reviewer, but as a person too. It all, and it's because of the things like that, like that quote, why do you care? It makes sense. Yeah. Totally makes sense.
I don't know if you know this. The great writer Don DeLillo had a book called The Information, and my dad actually gave it to me to read. And I get to this part and I go, do you know you're in this book? And he's like, what are you talking about? And there was the main character went on a radio show and got confused whether the interviewer was still interviewing him or reading a commercial. And so then when he interviewed DeLillo, he's like, did you catch you're in the book? And he's like, because my
That's
son
amazing.
Caught before I did.
I did not know that. I didn't know that. Yeah. DeLillo wrote my favorite book of all time. He wrote Underworld. That's my favorite book of all time.
Nick DiGilio, my favorite book of all time.
No kidding. Really? No, I buy that. I I've purchased that book probably 10 times for friends and things, and because it's the best book. It's the best book ever.
It's the best book ever. Prior to that, my favorite book was White Noise.
Okay. All right. What did you think of the Noah Baumbach movie? Did you see it?
Did not like it.
An A for effort. That's all I'm saying. Because when I heard they were going to make it, I'm like, how? What? But yeah, great though. I mean, I didn't know that we had that in common. Wow, man. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. And also, you're gonna love this is even better. When you were bumming around at Second City, do you know who was on the bar staff?
No, you got to remind me. No,
Noah Baumbach.
Wait a minute. What? He was?
So he and his brother took improv classes in L.A. with Jeff Michalski. They had a theater called The Upfront.
Yeah. And
Jeff called and got Joyce Sloan to put them on staff to take classes here. And they only lasted like 8 or 10 weeks because no one liked them and they didn't like us. It totally makes sense, right?
It's absolutely amazing. That is an amazing story. Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's wild. Okay. So 1987, I want to talk about two films. One, which is your pick, which John Borman's Hope and Glory, also in my top 10 all time.
Yeah.
Tell people about this film because I'll bet you most people haven't seen it.
I bet a lot of people haven't seen it either. It's autobiographical, loosely telling the story about John Borman when he was growing up. And he was growing up during the Blitz, World War II. And it was about how his family told him, you know, they sheltered him from what was really going on, which was a horrible death in World War. And they made it seem like it was joyous, that it was fireworks. And the movie is about, it's about this kid. And it's seen through the eyes of this kid growing up during World War II in the Blitz era in London. And his family. It's a rich, beautiful, moving, funny, lovely movie. And it was funny too, because I also remember when that movie came out, when I said that was my favorite movie of the year, your dad was surprised because I think it was his favorite movie of the year.
It was.
And we agreed on this really lovely, you know, kind of movie. And then meanwhile, and I don't know, if you look at the rest of my top 10 that year, there's horror. There's really dark, twisted stuff. And he's like, and you went with Hope and Glory. And people still to this day, even people who have read the book, are like, wait, Hope and Glory was your favorite movie that year? You're supposed to be gore guy. You know, you're supposed to. And I'm like, no. Borman is an amazing filmmaker. Yeah. And it's a great film. A great film. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think people aren't paying attention if they don't realize you're also very sentimental. That artistry, and it's not an easy film in that regard of like when you interrogate difficult childhoods and other things. So another film that came out that year, which is really important to me, is Broadcast News.
Oh man, yeah,
James L. Brooks. This is an early film that my wife Anne. So our kids went to Waldorf schools where they don't do media. So we had said to the school, look, we both work in the industry, so there are times where we're going to have media on the house because we have to. And so they were aware that we did a thing called Sunday Classic Movie Night, where both Nick and Nora were invited to watch if they wanted to, but we were going to watch like, you know, The Graduate or whatever it was. And Broadcast News was one of those. And Nick Leonard was, it was his favorite movie. And that's where he fell in love. We mentioned Albert Brooks.
Yeah.
He's got a monologue, if not a couple, in this film that will just strike you.
Yeah. Yeah. I Buried the Lead is one of the greatest lines ever.
I Buried the Lead.
No, I adore that movie, and I'm a big fan of James L. Brooks in general. His new movie, by the way, I liked it, and everybody hated it. Ella McKay, I liked it. If you're a James L. Brooks fan, you'll like it. If you're not, you might not. But no, Broadcast News, the thing about that movie is that not only was it accurate in terms of how it portrayed broadcasting and the media and news, it also just like really complex, flawed characters that do things where you question, like, what's going on here? And the heartbreak and the relationships between the three, and Albert Brooks, Holly Hunter, some of the best work she's ever done, and William Hurt, amazing in it, and Joan Cusack, great supporting performance in that, and it's littered with great character. Robert Prosky's in it. I mean, it's pretty much an almost perfect movie, and the fact that it like ended up like at number, I believe, like number 7 or 8 on my list that year is kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's wild. All right, we're gonna fast forward to 1999, which is Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia. Brilliant, brilliant film.
I'm glad you like it because it's divisive.
Is Magnolia divisive?
Oh my God. Yeah, Kelly. It's my favorite movie of all time. Magnolia. And when I tell people that, people are like, what is wrong with you? Or they immediately go, okay, explain the frog, smart guy. You know, and I'm like, I don't need to.
No, it's a brilliant. But the thing is, I didn't know that he was only 29 when he did it. And that made me a little mad.
I know. Yeah. He was like, when he did Hard Eight, he was like 26 or 25. Boogie Nights, 27. He was 27 years old when he made Boogie Nights. When I was 27, I was getting drunk and I had my finger up my nose. This guy's making Boogie Nights. Yeah. No. Wow. Magnolia, it's an extraordinary piece of work. It hits me on every level. I think as a piece of cinema, it's amazing the way it's made, the craftsmanship, the way it's shot, the acting is amazing, but also it emotionally knocks me out every time I watch it. Amy Mann's music is incredible. The performances are great. Melora Walters is Claudia, one of my favorite central performances in any movie. Like her looking at the camera at the end, smiling, finally, after 3 hours, it's just this cathartic moment that happens every time I watch it where I'm just like a mess. No, I adore Magnolia. I can't even describe how much I love it. Yeah.
I'm seeing Amy Mann this Friday at the Irish American Heritage Center. Yeah. I jumped over this, but in 1994, yeah. I was shocked that Forrest Gump was your favorite film.
Well, I get that. I get that a lot, especially because I have friends who are, you know, like I'm of the age, you know, like I just turned 60. And so when Quentin Tarantino's movies hit, we were in our 20s or late 20s when they hit.
Yep.
And people younger than me, maybe 5 years younger than me, and, you know, around a little bit younger than you and I are, Kelly. Of course, those Tarantino, when those movies came out, it was like, oh, dude, Essen, you know, and then the whole independent, you know, film thing became hip. And, you know, instead of being a rock star, you wanted to be a filmmaker. All of that stuff happened in the early to mid 90s. So the fact that I chose Forrest Gump over Pulp Fiction because my friends are like, there's something wrong with you. But Pulp Fiction, as much as I really love Pulp Fiction, it's in there. It's not my it's not my favorite. The reason I chose Forrest Gump, one, I think Robert Zemeckis is one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. I think he is an important American filmmaker who not only does really great subversive work, like, and I think Forrest Gump is a dark movie. A lot of people just kind of like go, oh, it's just this celebration. And also didn't help that like both major parties grabbed it as their movie, like the Democrats grabbed it and it became like this unnecessary there were all this political stuff that was piled on top of the movie that didn't want to be that. It's a really twisted little satire about America. And that's what Zemeckis does. I mean, Back to the Future has some dark stuff in it. I mean, that's one of the storylines in Back to the Future is possible incest. Like that's a major thing that and so he does that dark. He did a movie last year called Here that was with Tom Hanks and Robin Wright, Forrest Gump, reunited cast, and it was all from one camera angle point of view in a house, and I loved it. But it was dark. It was a real satire of those kind of movies, and people don't really like he works the movies really well where you cry and you get your emotions out there. He's really good at that. But there's always something underneath, something like you cry and then you go, man, why did I cry at this? This is just so twisted. But I think Forrest Gump is an extraordinary movie. And another thing that Zemeckis does is he's taken the technology of film and pushed it further. I mean, the stuff that he did in Back to the Future, the special effects, what he did in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I mean, there still has not been a live action animated movie that even matches that. And that movie came out in 88. So even on the technology, and then for a while, he did those stop motion, motion capture animated movies. He did Polar Express and Beowulf and all that. And he took a break from live action. Then he came back and did Flight in 2012, which is this incredible movie about alcoholism. Denzel Washington's best performance. It's proved that he still had it. So I love Robert Zemeckis all the way around. I think Forrest Gump is a beautiful movie on every level, dark, twisted, and moving. And I unapologetically adore that movie. And I get a lot of crap for that one.
That's what I thought. All right. I want to talk about one more movie, but before we do that, people don't. So one of the things from growing up with my dad and around these movies that I will always take with me. You've talked about some of the screening rooms, but we haven't mentioned the one where you would go to the alley at the Chicago Theater and there was an elevator that was a death trap. Like I can't believe it was so rickety. And I forget what floor. Was it 12th floor or something?
No, eighth
floor. Thank you.
Yeah.
And you get off and And the theater balcony of the actual Chicago Theater is right there. But then there's this little screening room, and there'd be Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel and my dad and you. Yeah. And whenever I could come, I would come. And that's where the bulk of the screenings I went to were in that screening room.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, the first time I went to that screening room, it was in 85. I can't remember what it was, but I remember I specifically pointed out in the book that I saw Back to the Future in that screening room.
Yeah.
And it was like kind of life changing because I was in this screening room and in this theater where I saw Halloween. Like it was in I saw Halloween, the John Carpenter movie Halloween in 1978. It changed my life. I found out what a director did and I started to dive in to what, you know, auteurism was and all that stuff. Like I really, in 1978, it changed my life when I saw Halloween and I saw it in that building and, you know, in a crappy, like Chicago theater was rat infested. And yeah, like your dad's like, it's right down here. And I'm like, what is this? And like you, you walk down that alley and you go into that entrance and I took the elevator. I'm like, where are we going? What's happening now? Are we going to a cockfight? What is this? Yes. And then we get up there, we go in and I'm like, wow. And there's a curtain, you know, like there was like not really a door. There was a doorway. You walked down a hallway, there's a curtain. Like, and I remember going in there and seeing several movies there. And it blew my mind. Like, I remember the first time I walked in there, because one of my heroes, I think the best film critic ever is Dave Kerr. And for a long time, we had Dave here writing for the Chicago Reader and then for the Tribune. And now he's in New York and he runs the film. He programs the films at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And he's fantastic. He's still amazing. And I remember like meeting him, like, oh my God, it's Dave Kerr from the Chicago Reader on that day. But it blew my mind that I was in the Chicago theater in this crappy little room watching these movies with people. So just like you had felt when you walked in there, like to this day, there's nothing like it. And if you ever see the movie Stony Island that Andy Davis made, there's an unbelievable moment in the movie where like they play musicians in that movie and they use the exterior alley of the Chicago theater, the entrance to get into that screening room as the back entrance to a club that they're playing. So it's, but they use that as the exterior. And I'm like, hey, that's, and in interviews, Andy Davis said, yeah, the reason I use that is because that's where the screening room was. And I knew about it. And that's where he wanted to shoot that scene. But it's incredible.
Anyone who had the honor of entering this weird thing, it was very special in part because there was only, you know, 100 of us who ever even knew or went up.
Absolutely. Probably. Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah. I tell that story now because I'm old and people just go, I don't know what you're talking about.
Same. Totally the same. Yeah. All right. The last film we're going to talk about is important to me. It's 2004. It's Sideways by Alexander Payne. Yeah. My mom rarely went to films. She like didn't care. This is the last film I saw in a movie theater that Ann and I went with my mom and dad.
Oh, man. Wow.
And also, we get out of that film, we went to dinner, and Anne's like, the Paul Giamatti character, because she didn't know you, she didn't say it was you, but she said the Paul Giamatti character was her brother. She's like, my brother is so, like, saw all these things. And you also had that sort of thing of like, it's almost too close. And it's such a layered performance. It's such a brilliant film. Talk about your reaction.
Well, you know, Sideways was a movie that, you know, I was on the cusp of 40 when I saw Sideways, and that's kind of what the movie's about. And the character of Miles that Paul Giamatti plays, he's, you know, he's kind of a jerk. He's kind of pretentious.
Super smart,
knows his stuff, knows his wine. Also, but clearly an alcoholic and, you know, and I am a recovering alcoholic. And, so when I saw that movie, I saw so much of me in that character. But I will say this, the one thing and everything that he does in the movie, like he's got a really screwed up friendship with this guy that he always has to bail out. Everybody has that. You know that, Kelly. Yeah, Every man has an idiot like that as a friend that you are always like apologizing for or trying to cover your ass and all that kind of stuff. So that relationship with Thomas Hayden Church, I've had that, you know, I've lived it. And all of the stuff that like instead of wine for me, it's movies. Like I get all pompous and pretentious about, you know, like for me, you know, if somebody says, I'm not going to have any Merlot, for me, it's Marvel. Like, I'm not going to have any Marvel. Like, that's what it is for me. So I identify with everything. And at that time, I was just turning 40 and I was like, oh my God. And it hit me on so many levels. And on top of it, it's hilarious. It's truthful. It's beautifully made, incredibly acted. Just on a simple level, it's a great, great movie, but it hit me personally at that time, turning 40, like it was the right movie to see. I loved it. And God, I can't believe that was the last movie that you saw with your, with your folks, man. Oh man. Now I love Alexander Payne. I just think his stuff, he's got a really appropriate last name because a lot of his movies are about pain.
Yes, they are.
And Giamatti's amazing. He didn't even get nominated that year, which was just incredibly ridiculous. And, no, but that's a movie that has a special, what's really funny is that movie came out the same year as Garden State. And I have friends of mine who are film critics, who are, one in particular is this guy, Eric Childress, who is a film critic now. He's 10 years younger than me. And I had him on my show, kind of like your dad would have me. I would have Eric on. He was 10 years younger than me, and I'd have him on to talk about movies and review movies with me. And the movie that hit him was Garden State, because that was a movie about turning 30. And Sideways was a movie about turning 40. And I find it fascinating that both of those movies came out at the same time. So 30-year-olds had a movie to see, and 40-year-olds had a movie to see. But now Sideways to me it's a very special movie in every way.
I think an overarching thing that you take away from reading this book is look back at your own viewing habits and what hit you. Look at how old you are and what was going on in your life. And that is a wonderful way to, that's why culture exists. It is a mirror for us to understand ourselves because,
I didn't know. I honestly, Kelly, I didn't know that that's how it was going to, I didn't know that that's how it was going to turn out. Like my initial idea was, I've been doing this for 40 years. Why don't I write 40 reviews? And then I was like, but my story's kind of unusual and I've gone through a lot of crap, in my life. And one of the things I wanted to point out was that film critics are human beings. Like what's happening in your life affects how you see a movie, like how it affects, how you react to it. Like if you bring baggage into a movie, like if you have something really crappy happen to you that day, you're bringing that into the screening room with you. And a lot of people are like, well, you're a film critic. You're supposed to separate that. I can't. I mean, and now, like, it's, like I point this out in the book, I got sober in 2015, fell off the wagon in 2020. But anytime there's a movie now, like there's a film in there called Colossal, which was my favorite movie of 2017, which I think is one of the best movies ever made, an allegory about alcoholism that I've ever seen. And I look at those movies differently. And they affect me differently. And when you're going through like a divorce or something, I went through a divorce when I saw Blue Valentine in 2010. I don't know if it would have been my favorite movie that year, but it was because of what I was going through. And I wanted to point that out, like what I was going through at GN and what I was going through in my personal life. I wanted to incorporate that in the reviews so that people understood why I felt the way I felt about each movie, to make it a little more personal.
It really works. All right. End the podcast asking for a yes and story. You took improv, but it doesn't have to be an improv thing. Is there a yes and moment in your life?
So now you, for people who might not understand, so yes and, now you're asking me, like, you say something to me and I have to say yes and, because that's it, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's basically in the context of this podcast.
Yeah.
And when we started working with the social scientists, they were like, this whole concept of yes and made sense to them because they're like, well, of course, because people's inclination is normally to say no and do nothing. Yeah. It is much easier to sit on the couch. And what people discover is that when they say yes, and then my wife would always say it's exploring and heightening, right? That's where all the good stuff lies. Yeah. And so everyone has those stories in their life when it's like, I didn't want to do this thing, and then I did it, and something really cool happened.
Right.
It feels to me as I was reading your book, like your life is a yes and. So it's like for better and worse. And
sometimes it zip zaps up. I don't know, okay. Well, you know what? The story I'm gonna tell is about how this book happened because it seems appropriate. This book happened because of my partner, Juliet, where she was like, you should write a book. You should write the book. You talk about it all the time. You should. And I'm like, nah, but it's too much. It's a pain in the neck. And it's, I don't know. I don't have it. And, and I've been kind of freelancing for a long time. Since I got the boot from GN, I've been kind of freelancing and not making as much money as I would like. And you gotta, people don't know this, but to write a book and to have a book printed up, it costs money. You pay for it. So my immediate response was no, I can't do this. I can't do it. And then finally she's like, you should do it. I'll help you out if you need the help in any way possible, but it's in you and you need to do it. And then I said, yes. And once I started writing it, once I got into the process of writing it, it was one of the best things that I've ever done in my life. So my yes and story is I thought no to writing this book at the insistence of my lovely partner, Juliet. I said yes, and now this is happening. And now I'm on your podcast. So there you go.
The book is called 40 Years, 40 Films. Everyone should get it. Nick DiGilio, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you, Kelly. It's been a pleasure, man.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.